Come and see. I am sure that most of us have from time to time run into a word, the word paradox. The probability increases when I suggest that you've probably heard the adjective paradoxical, as in that was a paradoxical statement. The definition of a paradox goes something like this. A paradox is a statement which, though true, seems false and self-contradictory. Every field of study, every human endeavor has within its culture and literature paradoxes. Now, if you go on Google and you Google the word paradox, especially check out Wikipedia, you'll be amazed at the list of paradoxes. Many of you know them very well. Some of the paradoxes are very common, such as, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Others are more complexing and are the problems that keep great philosophers and academics up all night. Some paradoxes have been around for thousands of years. Has anybody ever heard of the paradox, the ship of Theseus? Anybody heard of that? In this paradox, you go and you begin to replace a ship one piece at a time. But no matter how many pieces of the ship you replace, you always consider it to be the same ship. Now, consider that you replaced every single part of that ship over time. You still consider it the same ship. Now, take all the replaced parts, reassemble them. Now, do you have a new ship or the old ship, which still exists? There's also a value paradox. It asks, why is it that water is so essential to our survival, but diamonds are considered more valuable? Paradoxes are the kind of thing that one of my favorite characters from way back in the old Canadian Air Force show used to consider. He'd come on and do his bit. It was Ron Ferguson. He used to come out and he'd do this monologue called The Confused Philosopher. And boy, was he confused. He would ask all kinds of crazy questions. Some of his examples are, why is it that we park in driveways and drive on parkways? When you open a bag of cotton balls, do you have to throw the first one away? Is there anything such as military intelligence? Is it possible to have one trouser or one scissor instead of a pair? What color does a Smurf turn when he can't breathe? That's a good one. And why is it still a building after it's finished? Shouldn't it be called a built? And when ancient man ate chicken for the very first time, what did he say it tasted like? And frankly, what do you tell a duck when you want it to lower its head? He was a confused philosopher, wasn't he? And maybe, he was a confused philosopher because he lacked the one essential aspect that every philosopher has to have. He lacked community. The confused philosopher always appeared alone. But all the other great philosophers over the years, the great teachers of history, have always had a group of students or disciples that followed them, that learned from them, that interacted with them. In fact, the Greek word didaskalos, which means teacher, does not apply to anyone unless there's also one or more mathetes. And that's about all the Greek you're going to get from me. In Jesus' day and for hundreds of years before Jesus and after him, there were always teachers. And with every teacher, there was always pupils. There were always disciples. Now, the Greek people were really into this teacher-pupil thing. Although we have writings of several great philosophers, we can surmise that there were hundreds more Greek philosophers who left no writings at all, but they all had a little group of disciples, a little group of followers. And this little band of followers were always attracted to the main idea of the philosophers. The disciples chose to follow because they had some affinity with the teacher and they wished to explore in greater details the ins and outs of that philosopher's ideas. The Greeks were fascinated by the world in which they lived. Over centuries, they made detailed observations of what they saw and they speculated on the meaning of what they saw. You remember that story in Acts 17? Paul goes into Athens. And there we read that he debated Epicurean and Stoic philosophers who thought that Paul was a babbler. They even dragged Paul off to the Council of Philosophers to explain this new religion that he was promoting. Philosophy and the debate of philosophy is so ingrained in Athenian society that men, never women, men would always go to the city center, the agora, and they would sit around for hours and talk about all these philosophical ideas. It sounds like Tim Hortons to me, but anyway, okay. In Greek philosophy, and indeed most schools of philosophy, whenever a new idea arose, there might come along a new teacher. And then there would be a new group of students to embrace and promote that idea. For example, one of the paradoxical ideas that some Greek philosophers believed was that you could never step into the same river twice. Now, it seems like a confused idea, but you know, there's serious logic behind it. They believed it for two reasons. First, the river's moving. So the river you stepped in before is already downstream. And second, people are always changing, so you're never the same person twice. The Greeks also were into geometry and architecture. Who among us doesn't know the Pythagorean theorem that states that the square and the hypotenuse of a right-angled triangle are equals the sum of the square of the two sides? Boring, I know. But guess what? Pythagoras had a little school of disciples that followed him. Now, the Greeks were not alone in their thirst for knowledge because the Jews also had teachers and disciples. There were those who prided themselves on being a disciple of Moses. The devoted followers of Moses believed that Moses had received from God the law and their lives should be lived on the principles of the law. They also wanted other people to know these important concepts, so they too gathered disciples. There was a group in Jesus' day that we're very familiar with that were like that. You remember them? Pharisees. They took to following Moses even further. They concerned themselves with the interpretation of the law written in the Talmud and the Mishnah. They were so afraid of unwittingly breaking the law, so to protect people from transgressing the law, they came up with 250 new laws and 350 new prohibitions. And they gathered people together. They taught them these new commandments, and people identified themselves as their disciples. So I want to point out to you that the Greeks built a relationship on philosophy. The disciples of Moses based it on principle. The Pharisees based it on procedure. Into this mix of teacher and disciple, there comes something radically new. You see, John the Baptist had disciples too. Did you know that? John looked around at the way things were, and he didn't like what he saw, so he started a protest movement. That's essentially what he did. He was a wild man living outside of the establishment. His disciples were attracted to him because John was against something. So John's relationship with the disciples was based on protest. Now, as you can see, there are several ways to relate between a teacher and a student. The only thing all these groups had in common was that they had a leader and they had disciples who responded to the leader. Now, a new model emerges. A new model of discipleship. Jesus comes. He does something so radically different from the rest, it really stands out. Jesus invites everyone, and I mean anyone, to become his disciple. The relationship, though, is unique. It's not based on philosophy. It's not based on principle. It's not based on procedure. It's not even based on protest. Jesus makes a very, very simple invitation to people. He says this, "Come unto me." He goes to simple, hard-working fishermen mending their nets. He goes to a tax collector counting his money, and he simply says to them, "Follow me." In the Gospel of Mark, as we read over the passage where Jesus was choosing his disciples, Mark makes a very beautiful observation that we might overlook if we're not careful in our reading. Mark tells us that Jesus selected his disciples so that they might be with him. Maybe you're starting to see the profound difference between other teachers and Jesus. In the Jesus movement, if I can use that phrase, disciples were invited into a relationship with a person. They weren't just called to learn about the person, to be taught or believe or protest. This is a critical thing for us to understand, especially in light of our gospel lesson today. It's very common for people today to talk about Christian philosophy, Christian ethics, because they believe that there's a great deal of truth in the Christian faith. Perhaps people have spent some time, they've looked at all the other philosophies and come to the conclusion that Jesus taught, what Jesus taught is the best of the bunch. But that's as far as they go. Others may push it a bit further and say we need to define clearly what it means to be a Christian person. So they follow a Christian philosophy and they look to the church to give them some detail of what it means to do Christian philosophy, Christian ethic. So people state with some warmth, don't they, that they're a Protestant or they're a Catholic or they're a Baptist. They communicate to others their particular slant on Christ's teaching. And still others go further and say that we must also know what we must do if we're going to be Christ's followers. So they are very careful about laying out before us their convictions about Christian procedures. And then there are still others who talk about following Jesus as they are protesting something. Maybe they're protesting poverty or they're protesting war or social policies of the government or something else. Their lives seem defined by what they are against in the name of Jesus, these protesters. Now, there's nothing wrong with some or maybe all of these approaches, but there's something missing. And all of us know someone so obsessed with one aspect of discipleship they consider critical that they leave us cold. There's an odd thing that occurs in many self-professed followers of Jesus. They talk about Jesus a lot. They seem to hold within them, however, some unresolved anger. They seem devoid of any kind of grace to those who don't follow a strict code of discipleship. What can frighten us is that there's a real danger, I think, of knowing an awful lot about Jesus and knowing what we think he wants us to do, but we have no relationship with him. That was the situation in Corinth that Paul addressed in 1 Corinthians chapters 10 to 17. Here was a young church that was arguing amongst itself. It was very divisive. There was no harmony among the people. A good part of this dissension was on misplaced loyalties among the members of the church community. You remember what Paul wrote? Some of you will say, oh, I'm a follower of Paul. And others say, I follow Apollos, or I follow Peter, or I follow only Christ, some said. Can Christ be divided into pieces, Paul says? You see, this might surprise you, but being a follower of Jesus isn't about philosophy. It's not about procedure. It's not about principles. It's not about protest. Christian discipleship is unique among every other religion and philosophy there is because it invites us to know Jesus. Not just as teaching, we are to know Jesus. This is especially important to recognize in our modern world with mass technology and mass media. You know, it's so easy to get trapped into a misplaced loyalty to a popular teacher or preacher at the expense of knowing Jesus. We can be so captured by the attraction of a teacher's methods and their message that we fail to test it by Christ's truth or even by other teachers. We come to our gospel lesson particularly now. Beautiful story. Philip meets Jesus. He meets him. And Philip's invited to be a disciple. He's very excited. His first reaction is to do what? To go and find Nathanael. And Philip is so excited about his encounter with Jesus. He says to Nathanael, "We found the very person that Moses and the prophets have wrote about. His name is Jesus, the son of Joseph of Nazareth." Nathanael responds with this famous remark, doesn't he? "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" Remember, it was a little backwater town. Now this is a critical moment for Nathanael. You can see God's hand all over it. Philip could have hunkered down. He could have sat there with Nathanael and argued the merits of following Jesus. He could have thrown all kinds of information at Nathanael. If he were alive today, he could have put out the four spiritual laws track. He could have given a book on apologetics to try and convince Nathanael to believe in Jesus. Instead, what does the Bible say he did? He says simply, "Just come and see for yourself. Come meet Jesus. See if a relationship with him is what your soul longs for." Maybe Nazareth was a backwater kind of place, but Philip thought he'd found something of great value. He'd found the pearl of great price. He'd found the treasure hidden in a field which was worth everything he owned. Borrow a metaphor from the parables. I ran across an interesting story in the Associated Press from back in 2004. In the slum district of Manila, which is always overcrowded, there was a gold rush that made things worse. It all started when a 15-year-old boy named Alfredo Gallo was combing the riverbed that runs through the Philippine capital looking for something of value. And he found a chunk of gold. His father immediately sold the nugget for $500 and bought a television and a bicycle. Once word got out, hundreds of people flocked to the banks of that filthy river looking for that precious metal. Though the river is filthy and strewn with garbage and sewage, people began to see it with new eyes. One village chief commented, "It's a puzzle. All we got before this was trash." Nathanael could not believe that anything good would come from Nazareth. But he soon discovered that the very best treasure of all came from that little village. And that treasure was not a philosophy to apply to life. It wasn't a principle to follow. It wasn't a procedure. A procedure to make one happier or more acceptable to God. It wasn't a protest to commit one's energy to. The precious treasure, more valuable than all you possess, is Jesus. And so I wonder, have you found that treasure for yourself?